everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. I'm your host, Bridget Keys, and I'm the only host. Where's TJ? Well, you'll have to ask him. I want to thank everyone for your patience over the past few weeks as we've been trying to relaunch the Cabot Cove Gazette, and I thank especially everyone who sent in recordings and tried to participate in being a guest host. Your episode will be up very, very soon, but this week, since it's a special holiday, we're going to do a rebroadcast of a special episode we did when we first started the podcast on Angela Lansbury's 1996 TV movie, Mrs. Santa Claus. If you haven't seen the movie, you can watch it for free on plenty of streaming sites like Amazon Prime, Tubi, Pluto, etc., which is great because when I first watched it, I had to download an app and pay money for it, and I was really annoyed about it. So go watch Mrs. Santa Claus, 1996, and come back here to join us for a special rebroadcast of our original episode about it. Hello and welcome to a very, very special merry episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. I'm your host, Bridget Keys.
And I'm your co-host, TJ West.
And today we are talking about Mrs. Santa Claus, Angela Lansbury's 1996 TV movie.
Yes, and what a delightful and jolly film it is. In fact, one of the things that surprised me the most was how much I actually unironically enjoyed it as I sat down last night to prepare for this podcast. So what do you think, Keys? What were some of your takeaways?
I don't think that I quite enjoyed it as much as you, but of course I did enjoy it because it's Angela Lansbury. But, you know, the movie is set in 1910, and the premise is that Lansbury is married to Santa Claus, who ignores her all through the Christmas season, and she spends every Christmas Eve alone, and she's really kind of disenchanted with life, and she is obviously really, really good at North Pole stuff. Like, she manages all the elves, and they got the toys ready a week early this year. She has a new route for Santa Claus to take that will cut down his travel time on Christmas Eve. And nobody really listens to her or appreciates what she does. So she decides to take the reindeer and follow the new route just to make sure it works and give herself a little bit of an adventure before Christmas. And she crash lands in New York City in 1910.
And then she meets quite a few of the colorful denizens of Avenue A, which was giving me Avenue Q. I almost said Avenue Q.
Very different tone.
So, as a result, she ends up seeking employment with a curmudgeonly, villainous toy maker, where she basically leads the children into, like, a strike and a work slowdown, because apparently Mrs. Santa Claus is a labor organizer in this movie's universe. But she also meets, like, a young suffragette, she meets a young Italian immigrant, she meets some Jewish immigrants, so eventually, of course, she gets back into the sleigh once the reindeer have recovered, goes back to the North Pole, where she reunites with Santa Claus, and then he actually invites her to go with him on his new excursion, which, using the new map, she has designed to make sure that they get everywhere more efficiently.
We spend a lot of time with the setup of Avenue A and what this turn-of-the-century New York looks like, and the big show-stopping number is, you know, Welcome to Avenue A, where you can hear Come sta, bless my soul, and oy vey. Mm-hmm. You know, so this pastiche of immigrant cultures that have all landed in New York. And in this movie, they all live side by side, really harmoniously.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about it was, I mean, it didn't really fetishize difference in a way I might have expected from an earlier era. Not that it was necessarily the most culturally sensitive movie, but it did, as you say, point out that there are people, like, living in kind of a utopia. Like, there's something very utopian, which makes sense since it's a musical. But you have, like, you know, a priest and a rabbi sort of greeting each other cordially. You have the moment when the young suffragette leads, like, a whole bunch of people from different ethnic backgrounds on a march down the street. So this is definitely a vision of 1910s New York that is significantly more placid than it probably was in its in the real world, which was, you know, as you pointed out, like, there were distinct neighborhoods and they did not get along with each other.
Not all. I mean, some people did, but yeah, it's a really sweet and lovely depiction of New York and its diversity. And what I especially like is that we have this character who's I mean, she's kind of a Rose Nyland, right? She comes from the north.
Uh-huh.
She's relatively isolated. She's never been to a big city. And she lands here and she gets along with everybody. It's not shocking to her. Mm-hmm. She doesn't struggle to understand different cultures. She is happy to eat bagels, and she stays at the boarding house of a Jewish woman, and she takes to her daughter, the suffragette, Sadie, and she just really fits in with this world, and it takes to her too, and soon she's actually helping to change it and make them all much happier. But I just thought it was really lovely how we have this, because that's so important, I think, to Angela Lansbury's star persona, the idea that she kind of gets along with everyone, and she's such a, what's the word I'm looking for, Tej?
A national treasure. That's what she is. A national fucking treasure.
She's a national treasure who doesn't even belong to the U.S., but maybe she does now. It's been a long time that she's been here.
She's a true gem. Like, and I feel like...
She is.
And I feel like, you know... I feel like nowadays she's underappreciated. Like, I mean, we have Betty White, who is, like, sort of seen as this national treasure. Like, she is understood. Everybody knows Betty White. And I feel like that Angela Lansbury has yet to ascend to that kind of luminary position. Maybe it's because she's not 100 yet. But, I don't know, it just feels like she doesn't have the kind of ubiquity in our culture that she probably should, given just
how... And she should, I think. Yeah, I think the comparison to Betty White is fair. They both have careers that have spanned about the same amount of time, and certainly... the same amount of projects. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the difference is that we like Rose Nyland from the Golden Girls and Betty White's sort of naive charm and the humor of that show. And Angela Lansbury has tended to be in more serious projects. Not necessarily like high drama, but, you know, not comedy and sitcom. And right. So we don't memeify her as much, right?
Right, because even, I mean, just as an example, like the fact that we're doing this podcast on that, you know, Murder, She Wrote suggests, and there that Murder, She Wrote has a different afterlife than the Golden Girls. Like, it has its fans, we hope, but it doesn't have the kind of, like, pervasive cultural afterlife that the Golden Girls has always had.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I didn't even know this movie existed, and I was trying to understand... In 1996, I would have been 16, so did I miss it because I was just a little bit too old for a family heartwarming Christmas movie? You know, was I in my, like, cynical teenage years, or did I miss it because it wasn't promoted that much?
I mean, I remember watching it because I was 12, because I'm slightly younger than you, so just to point that out to our listeners. But I do remember watching this, which, I mean, but I haven't seen it literally since 1996. Like, I don't think I've seen it at any point in the intervening, like, 30 years. Like, I haven't seen it, and it hasn't...
It's not one of those movies that you can count on seeing every Christmas on TV or something.
Speaking of sort of Angela Lansbury and her many projects, was that there were shades of, like, Portobello Row from Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which I know we both adore, in the choreography of Avenue A, but also just in the very, like, highlighting this melting pot of a location in the same way that Bedknobs and Broomsticks does with Portobello Row in London.
Yeah, although I think there's a kind of exotic mysteriousness to Portobello Road that Avenue A doesn't have. It was definitely more of sappy happy. But yeah, I got Portobello Row vibes totally. Maybe that's because Bedknobs and Broomsticks is my my favorite and my most well-known Angela Lansbury movie. And I know people are thinking, like, but what about Mrs. Potts? And yeah, okay, sure. But I've seen Bedknobs and Broomsticks like 900 times. So it's
yes.
In my head.
Uh-huh.
And it was also interesting to me that it's set in 1910 because you had said, hey, let's watch this Christmas movie. I didn't know that it was historically set.
Neither did I. I forgot that part.
You didn't remember that. And then I also didn't know that it was the bulk of the movie actually takes place in Manhattan. We have very few scenes set at the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm expecting to watch this Christmas movie, and I felt like I crash-landed into ragtime, really.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly good comparison. And, I mean, that was what surprised me, too. I was like, I don't remember this movie having this, you know, quasi-Marxist consciousness that, you know, that emerges as it goes on. I was like, I don't remember Mrs. Santa Claus being a labor organizer. Like, these were not the things that I necessarily remembered. But that's part of what I think gives this movie a lot more depth than I had anticipated when I suggested that we talk about it.
So yeah, let's talk about the two big themes then. The one that connected me to ragtime, I think, was probably the women's suffrage. So we have Sadie, the young Jewish woman who stands on an actual soapbox on the streets shouting speeches about women's rights and votes for women. And the whole neighborhood just kind of turns her off. They think she's annoying and loud. But once Mrs. Claus, who's going by the name Mrs. North at this point, once she gets involved, she gets Sadie to go to people individually and talk to them about what's going on in their lives. And then suddenly the women are marching in the street all together. Mm-hmm. And they really appreciate Sadie. And it's like they kind of understand how women's rights touches them.
There's a surprising awareness of like the genuine struggles that people had in the early part of the, like particularly immigrants had in the early part of the 20th century. Like Mrs. Lowenstein, which, you know, is the Jewish matron, talks about, you know, there's a very oblique allusion to, like, the pogroms of, like, the 19th century. Like, it's there in the background, like, surprisingly.
Well, you should explain, she keeps a suitcase packed.
Yeah, in case she has to flee.
Because she's worried that because of Sadie, they'll get in trouble with the police and they'll have to flee and leave America at any point. And so there's really a kind of tension about their safety and comfort in the U.S. as Jewish immigrants.
Right. And I mean, it's interesting that the woman who plays Mrs. Lowenstein was in Fiddler on the Roof. So there's a lot of, like, mm-hmm. metatextuality going on there. But it's a surprising, like, awareness for a relatively lighthearted musical that has not a whole lot of narrative tension to nevertheless have these, you know, faint echoes of the actual violence that were often very much a part of the immigrant experience in 20th century America.
Yeah, we'll talk about the child labor in a second, but we also, the reason the children are laboring, we see Nora, who's an Irish girl who also lives at Mrs. Lowenstein's house. She becomes, like, really good friends with Mrs. North, who takes her under her wing, but Nora is free all day unless she's working in a factory because her dad has to work double shifts. And he's trying to save up money to bring her mom and baby brother from Ireland. So because of his work, this child is basically just left alone to run around New York unsupervised all day.
Mm-hmm. And get in trouble with the police.
And get in, yeah, lots of trouble with the police. So another example of the ways that the movie doesn't shy away from some of the darker aspects of early 20th century immigrant life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, what's interesting then is that it manages to do so while not losing sight of the fact that it is a musical. So, like, there are plenty of, like, musical numbers that keep it lighthearted. And I think that's part of what makes the movie work, is that it manages to sort of do as the best musicals do, combine sort of, you know, significant social commentary, but not losing sight of the entertainment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Avenue A was like just a fantastic showstopper of a number. There was even the crane shot, of everyone in the neighborhood dancing in the intersection, which is such a like wonderful classical musical moment.
I mean, that was when I thought, I was like, oh, this is what I missed about like classic Hollywood musicals.
Yeah.
I was like, this is absolutely, I just felt myself swept up with the euphoria. That was probably my favorite moment in the movie, quite frankly, is that Avenue A.
And then in terms of singing, kind of taking away from the grimness, trying to make it a little bit more lighthearted, I think what stood out to me was the first song that Mrs. North sings at Tavish Toys. So Mrs. North, Mrs. Santa Claus, right? She's going by this pseudonym, so no one knows who she is. She rents a room from Mrs. Lowenstein for free, which is kind of amazing. And Mrs. Lowenstein's like, you look nice. You'll get a job.
Yeah.
And then you can pay me back. You're clean, basically, is the undertone, right? So indeed she does. She immediately gets a job at Tavish Toys because, of course, she has all this experience in the toy industry. And her job is to supervise the child laborers. And we're told that something really bad happened to their previous supervisor. So we have a kind of like Mary Poppins vibe here. And mm-hmm. she's going to be so nice and loving and fun that the kids are all going to let her supervise them. And she sings this song about how she's almost young. Mm-hmm. Right? She's old and gray, but she's almost young at heart. And they're all playing around the toy factory while they're singing it.
What I was thinking as I was watching that number, I was like, I felt like it was, again, one of those meta moments where Angela Lansbury was sort of saying, like, you know, I might have just come off my run with Murder, She Wrote, and people might be trying to write me off as, like, you know, going into the sunset, but I'm still going to, you know, embrace my inner child. And she's very sprightly. I mean, what, like, what I found very fun about this movie is the amount of, like, just embodiment of Angela Lansbury. Like, she dances slightly. She has that lovely red dress at the end, which, you know, is pretty low cut for a woman in her, what, late 60s at this point?
Like, oh, no, she's older than that at this point.
Yeah, so what, she's probably, like, 70, right? Like, you know, so there's this moment of just, like, Angela Lansbury, like, you know what? Don't try to write me off, because I'm going to just sing and dance and show off, you know, a little bit of cleavage, and I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm going to channel my inner Mame at this moment. Like,
so, of course, all the kids, like, fall in love with her, and that's when she realizes that the working conditions for them are really terrible. There's no heat. There's a furnace or a stove, but there's no coal.
Mm-hmm.
They work really long hours. Their fingers are frozen. And, of course, the owner of the factory, Tavish, he deliberately makes the toys shoddy because the motto is, it only has to last till Christmas. So ultimately, she's so, I think, upset by the conditions that she asked Tavish, you know, can we at least have some heat in here? Like, these poor kids, right? Like, it's bad enough that they're children and they're not getting an education. They're working. But they don't even have heat. And he's like, nah.
Nah. So I'm glad that you gave me the entry into Tavish's character, because I really want to talk about this character. And because I don't think he gets enough screen time, for one thing. But so he's played by Terrence Mann. So if anyone's, like, musical theater aficionados, they know that, you know, Mann has a pretty well-established, like, oeuvre of stage performances, which is very clear in the kind of mincing, overly mannered performance that he gives. Like, it's clear that he's playing it as a sort of theatrical melodrama villain. So there's not a lot of sophisticated, you know, goings on. But what especially stood out to me is, like, my God, this guy is queer. I mean, Terrence Mann is not queer, but, like, his performance as Tavish is just laden with all of these sort of connotations of queerness. Like, as I said, the overly manneredness, the sort of overly dramatic way that he delivers his lines. And one of the things that stood out to me, and the nearest comparison I could think of, was, like, he was giving me Tim Curry vibes. Like, Tim Curry, mm-hmm. as in, like, Dr. Frank, but also Tim Curry is the front desk clerk in Home Alone 2. Like, that sort of mouth-twisty, almost mustache-twirly kind of acting that I find just simply delicious to watch.
He also looks a little bit like Tim Curry. I think there's the pale skin and the dark hair, and the hair has a little bit of a curl in it. So I didn't see this until you said it, and then I was like, yes, because something about Tavish was hitting me, and I couldn't articulate how and why. And yeah, he's giving me Tim Curry vibes, which of course is also giving me queer vibes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tim Curry would be fine with us making that correlation. And then it's like, well, so what we have then is the stereotypical queer villainy plot, right?
Right.
The only bad guy in the whole movie is the one who's queer.
Right. And I mean, if I were to put on my academic hat for a moment, not that it's ever very far away, but I would say that, you know,
it's
kind of like...
never off.
It would be, like, I would say he's, like, the antisocial, child-hating queer. Like, he could be a potential, like, point of rupture from the film's otherwise really sort of straight and straightforward sort of story about children being good and children being the sort of, you know, the bearers of the future and all that sort of thing. But part of what gives him his punch and makes him an enjoyable character to watch is that he resists all of that, at least until the end, when he's given, a literal one-minute redemption arc, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, his evilness is solved really easily because there's no real conflict in this movie. Mrs. North, Mrs. Claus, figures out that he had a stepbrother who once stole his teddy bear.
Yes.
And now he hates everyone and everything. And so she just gives him a new bear. And then he agrees, like, okay, I'll be nice now.
I understand, like, this is a TV movie, so we don't and it's a musical, and it's Christmas, so we don't necessarily need this huge, like, redemption for this character, but even in that standard, I was just like, wow, that was really quick. It was like, because I kept looking at the time, I was like, we have, like, 10 minutes left, and, like, what's going to happen with Tavish? Like, he's clearly, because Mrs. Claus leads, like, a citywide boycott against, like, his toys, because they're all shabby. And then, you know, he has this moment where he's like, Mrs. North, and, you know, and has this confrontation with her in the stable where the reindeer are being housed. And then it just magically resolves in, like, 5 minutes. And I was like, okay, well.
I know who you are. You're Mrs. Claus, and I've taken your reindeer. Here's a teddy bear. Okay, you can have your reindeer. Excellent writing.
Yeah, but I guess that's a keeping with like a certain kind of maybe a B-level musical where the things are resolved very quickly because there's just not really a lot of stakes to start with.
Well, and I think a sort of family children's movie that lacks the particular sophistication that maybe children's movies today do, but you know, the stakes are never really very high because everything needs to be really nice in the end, right?
Okay, so, once she becomes in the toy factory, and we have these child labor issues and she sees how abject they are, she really develops what I think we could call like this Marxist consciousness that they can only overcome Tavish if they work together. Like they can't be separate and have this still work. And that's a really important like component. I mean, and it's one of those moments where like I think the film has a surprisingly, I wouldn't say sophisticated necessarily, but a surprisingly complicated understanding of, how actual labor politics work, that it only works when you're all together. And that Tavish himself realizes that too.
Yeah, and that she has gotten all this advice from Sadie, so that again, this character that we think would be this really naive, northern recluse is like, hey, you work on women's rights. You probably understand how this stuff works. Sit down and give me advice so I can organize a work slowdown in my factory with child labor. I mean, she's really actually really politically minded as a character.
Yeah, and I mean certainly for diegetically it comes from the fact that she really does care about children and she cares about like delivering quality quality toys. Like she is definitely should be in charge of the quality control department in the North Pole.
Well, it's so sweet. She says to him, he has this whole shtick that things don't need to last. And she says, but have you ever seen the look on a kid's face when their toy breaks? It's really sweet.
Yeah, and I mean that's really isn't that the brilliance though of Angela Lansbury's performance? Like I know we talk about a lot about her star text and we talk a lot about like how people like view her, but I mean so much of it is just reliant on her performance. Like she's just such a masterful performer that I think that those little moments are like grace notes that we wouldn't have if it were someone less skilled at what they do, and it comes I think from her like sort of threefold skills as a movie, as a film, as a sorry, as a film, television, Broadway actress. Like she really does understand how performance works and how to modulate her performance for what avenue she's appearing in. And I think that those kind of moments really testify to that.
Absolutely. And the work slowdown doesn't work because Tavish is like, y'all so dumb, I'll just fire you and replace you with other kids. And then they're like, okay, well, then we're going to go on strike. So they start a public awareness campaign. And the next thing we know, they're getting newspaper headlines and the mayor is calling for a boycott of child labor in New York. So really has a tremendous impact on the city of New York and its social and political future. Just from her 1 week of living there.
Which is so interesting then that we have this relatively, at least at first blush, harmless old lady character who becomes like the engine of social change, broad social change is brought about.
She's the Jane Addams of
Yes,
Avenue A.
exactly. Like or the Mother Jones. Like she's really sort of leading the charge. In this moment of tremendous epochal change, which of course, that's why the setting is so important, because it is also a period of tremendous unrest.
So, the setting of 1910, I think, is really important because it gives us an opportunity to sort of educate the audience on all these sort of issues. But I also couldn't stop thinking about the fact that this was made in 1996 when I was watching, especially from the perspective of the women's issues. I mean, 1996 is when Hillary Clinton is in the White House as First Lady. And we're again having daily, pop culture debates about, what women are allowed to do, and especially a woman standing next to a husband who's getting all the credit for doing the thing, which is the parallel here with Mrs. Claus, right? He gets all the accolades, and she's actually doing tons of work behind the scenes.
I had actually not thought of that, but that's an absolutely brilliant reading of what's happening and like situating this TV movie historically, like and politically, like. But I do think that that's really astute to point out that, Mrs. Claus is basically the Hillary Clinton of, this movie.
Which I think is why it's important to talk about how the movie ends. I mean, throughout the movie, we have little cuts back to the North Pole where we can see it takes Nick, as she calls him, an awfully long time to even realize she's gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's gone for like 2 or 3 days before he even realizes it. And he only realizes it because his cocoa doesn't taste good.
Yeah.
And he figures out that an elf must have made it because she makes good cocoa. I mean, I just kept writing, honestly, I could do without these cuts back to the North Pole. Santa sucks. Stay single was another thing I wrote down.
Well, it also doesn't help that Charles Durning, who I love as an actor, does definitely seem to be phoning it in here. Like, he's definitely not giving one of his most dynamic performances. Like, it's just, I mean, clearly the movie's energy is being driven from the New York scenes, and these are just kind of thrown in.
Yeah, but they are supposed to show us that ultimately he does miss her and want her back. And ultimately, it's Christmas Eve. The reindeer who was injured in the crash landing is healed. And it's time for her to go back. And she's sort of standing at this event, watching everyone else pair off. And she's talking about how much she misses him and needs him. And he, more importantly, the song starts with her saying, he needs me. So she's going to go back. TJ, I hated this so much. What a kind of message is this? I mean, it's sort of like she's had this amazing Bridges of Madison County, you know, like my boring little domestic married life. I'm going to go have an adventure and then I'll return to my boring domestic life and I'll carry those memories with me forever because that's probably the only adventure I'll ever get in my sad, pathetic life. I mean, what kind of ending was this, TJ? It was awful.
Okay, so a couple of things are worth noting. One, I think that it's an interesting parallel to the Sadie and Marcello's romance. So it's an interesting parallel because it's clear that, like, Mrs. Santa Claus sort of oversees their courtship. And it's, you know, that they are a marriage of, are going to be a marriage of opposites, which they have a lovely musical number that relates just how opposite they are. They talk about, like, all kinds of odd food pairings, like borscht and pizza, or I don't know, something else that's... It's a very classic Hollywood moment, which classic Hollywood musical moment that I personally really enjoyed. So that's an interesting parallel then that, you know, part of what Mrs. Claus realizes is that she, you know, misses Nick. And I don't necessarily disagree with your dislike of that ending, but I don't know how it could have ended otherwise. Like, I don't, because it's just, that's just not how musical narratives work. Like, this is not like some sort of avant-garde, you know, text that's going to like challenge us and shatter the patriarchy.
I mean, I would love her to be like, dude, you do Christmas. I got a great life here in New York. But obviously that's not going to happen. But they could have written it in a way that it didn't feel like Santa, as you say, is just sort of phoning it in and he's like, yeah, I wish she'd come back.
But see, that's the thing. I actually, the more I sit here and think about it, the more I don't necessarily entirely disagree or agree with you, but I think it's a little more nuanced than I think you're recognizing, because that he does give her a nice coat at the end. But I actually think there's more going on with that nice coat than what...
So we should explain that the coat is the sort of classic red cloak with white trim, you know, the Mrs. Claus cloak that he gives her, and he tells her, you're going to ride with me.
Right. She is being reincorporated back in and given a more substantial role in the workings of the North Pole than she had at the beginning. So I think that there is some movement.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to see that it's going to be a partnership from now on, right?
She's equally important. Yep.
Yeah. I hated it.
So I think it's a little more sophisticated and a little more, I don't want to say progressive, but...
He's calling me unsophisticated and my reading unnuanced, but the thing is that I'm actually a very sophisticated reader. I just hated it. The other thing is that she's made all these relationships with all these people in New York. She's very close to them. I mean, it's only been a week, but, like, these are really life-changing friendships. And she tells Nora, you know, I know you're going to miss me, but all you have to do is just look up at the stars and you'll see the stars and think of me. And this was a gimmick that Mrs. Claus and Mr. Claus did. They look for the North Star as their sort of compass. But I also, as a child of the 80s, couldn't help but think of An American Tale.
Especially because of this
immigrant New York setting, right? Uh-huh. So just look up at the star and somewhere out there, you know. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that we have these, like, cultural touchstones, like these kind of moments in pop culture that echo across different, like, within certain type time frames. Like, I think that, as you say, like, the audience for this movie would have been, like, people either your age or my age or just slightly younger. But ours was the perfect age to sort of get that reference. Like, would have at least had that in our sort of cultural architecture in the back of our mind, because we would have grown up seeing An American Tale, and so we would have recognized that as such.
Oh, yeah. And hearing the song on the radio, it was on the radio a lot.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and it's the same reason we would have also, like, the audience for this would have also recognized Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Potts. Like, the children aren't part of the audience anyway. Even as the adults would have recognized her as Jessica Fletcher, but the young kids would have seen her as Mrs. Potts.
Yeah. Did you get Mrs. Potts vibes other than that she's a Mrs. and she sings and dances?
No, I think that this character is much more, like, dynamic and active in the way... She's more of an Eglantine Price than a Mrs. Potts.
Eglantine Price is much, from Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yeah, so she's much more active and much more of an agent than the sort of matronly background character that Mrs. Potts is.
I thought so, too. I felt like there's quite a lot of similarities between this and Bedknobs and Broomsticks, even despite really different settings and ultimately really different goals for the movie. But as we say, she does go back to the North Pole in the end, and maybe to have a happier mm-hmm. life with Nick. I am skeptical. But it wouldn't be okay unless all the loose ends back in New York were tied up. So Nora, for instance, who is now left basically alone, you know, she was on her own, and now she had this nice lady to sort of watch over her and be her friend. But mm-hmm. Nora's mom arrives on Christmas. She's come from Ireland to the U.S., so that loose end is tied up. Sadie and Marcello have acknowledged their love.
Mrs. Lowenstein gets the extra candlestick that she was missing, like, because one of the candlesticks from her mother was missing, and now she has its companion. It's just, yeah, as you say, it's very lovely that all the pieces start to... And she also has a romance with the cop, which I
always forget. Yeah, Mrs. North, Mrs. Claus orchestrates a relationship between the police officer who's constantly chasing Nora and Mrs. Lowenstein, who had been terrified of him because she mm-hmm. thought he would try to deport her. And they recognize that actually they're quite interested yeah. in each other. So it's a really lovely ending where everything gets tied up in a really happy way. And so even though I wanted Mrs. North to stay in New York because I thought she had a kick-ass life there, it's okay for her to leave because she's left everything better than she's found it. And these people will all be okay without her.
Yeah, and I mean, that's sort of like her dramatic role and her sort of narrative role has been fulfilled. But, you know, she's brought all the people that need to be together, that she has, you know, solved the child labor crisis of New York City single-handedly. Like, I think that that's quite utopian in the way that one would expect of a musical. And she does all this in an hour and a half, which I think is really impressive that we managed to.
She does it all in an hour and a half screen time and a week in narrative time. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, look at it this way. I mean, Jessica Fletcher is always solving mysteries in, like, 45 minutes. So I feel like, you know, that's very much in keeping with, you know, Angela Lansbury's superpowers.
Angela Lansbury is not a woman who wastes time, okay? She gets in and gets shit done.
Exactly.
And ultimately, the last line of the movie, in keeping with this theme of, you know, everybody's going to be okay and everybody has their happy ending, is, as long as you love one another, you'll have the best Christmas of all. What did you make of that, TJ?
That is a moment and a line that could only have come out in a TV movie in the 1990s. And I said this to you in the pregame that one of the things that I found really interesting about this as a made-for-TV movie is that I can't imagine a major network, making this movie today, like, and broadcasting it in prime time today. Like, this kind of... I use the word saccharine, but I don't mean that derogatorily. Like, it is saccharine and sweet and kind and sincere. This kind of sincerity is not really popular or in vogue at the moment. So you would see it maybe on Hallmark. Harmless entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and entertainment that's sincere in its heartwarmingness. There's no right. sort of irony to it.
It's designed not to offend, like, and mm-hmm. to sort of make you feel good. And that's part of the reason I enjoyed it. So I enjoyed it much as I enjoyed Murder, She Wrote, because it has a kind of, like, nostalgia to it. And it's not that the 90s were perfect, but they were certainly in some ways a less cynical, horrible age than what we're living in right now. As I said, I found a surprising amount of things to talk about. Like, I kept thinking as I was watching it, I can't wait to talk about this with Bridget, like, because I know there's going to be so much we're going to be able to dive into. Even a relatively, quote-unquote, simple fare, there's often a lot of complexity, as we always like to say.
There is, and that's why I think people shouldn't underestimate television.
Or just popular genres more generally. Because I think that what you're pointing to is like...
popular entertainment.
As this movie, and as Murder, She Wrote itself reveals, there's always something to reward closer scrutiny.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. So we should tell listeners that we recommend that you watch this because we did find so much value in it. And you can watch it at the Hallmark Movies Now app or the Hallmark Movies Now channel on Amazon Prime or Roku or wherever you get your streaming channels.
And they have a one-week free trial. So if you don't want to watch other Hallmark Fare, you can just watch this.
I don't know why you wouldn't want to watch other Hallmark Fare, though, but...
Well, I don't know either, but it's not everyone's cup of chamomile tea, so.
Did you just say chamomile?
Yeah.
Is that how people say it in West Virginia?
I don't actually know that people drink chamomile tea in West Virginia. I'm not sure they would even have heard of it. We drink sweet tea in West Virginia, so.
I was going to ask if it's a sweet tea place. Is it far enough south for sweet tea?
I grew up drinking sweet tea, so yeah.
Did you really? That is so foreign to me.
Yeah, well, that's the mark of culture right there.
And the first time I ever had it, I thought it would just be like, you know, like iced tea with some sweetener.
Nope.
I didn't realize that it was sugar with a dash of tea in it.
That's the best kind, yeah.
We should wrap this up.
We should.
So, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Cove Gazette. You can also find us on Facebook at the Cabot Cove Gazette. Our theme song is Reaching the Sky, composed by Alexander Nakarada under Creative Commons license. And I'm Bridget Keys.
And I am TJ West.
Thank you for joining us for this very merry special episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. We'll be back with our regular episode analysis next week.